This is the fourth day of this June 2017 seven-day session. I'm going to switch horses here and go to a text I've often read from in Taisho, a book called Dream Conversations on Buddhism and Zen. And it's a collection of teachings, written replies to questions about Zen, written by Muso Kokushi, also known as Muso Soseki, who lived in the generation after Chinese Zen master Fuyan. This is a Japanese Zen master, Muso Kokushi. Kokushi means national teacher. His dates are 1275 to 1351, so he was born just after Zen master Dogen died. Just a little bit about him. His teaching was largely, this book, Dream Conversations, was translated by Thomas Cleary. And in his introduction, he tells us that Muso's teaching was largely based on the great Buddhist text called the Source Mirror Record, a massive Chinese collection of extracts from the Buddhist canon, combining the teachings of the various schools with the message of Zen. He says this, the text still exists, but it is no longer studied in Japanese Zen schools. Most of what this national teacher Muso wrote is in this collection, Dream Conversations. Muso Kokushi is also famous as a master of the way of calligraphy and of the art of garden design, which he mentions here. We probably will be reading that segment. I'm going to just dive in here in the middle of the book. It's a short book. And he says, it is said that people who are truly on the way do not discuss judgments of others. This does not mean that they make judgments but suppress them. It means they do not see people in terms of self and other. The third patriarch of Zen said, in the realm of being as is, there is no other and no self. Probably referring to our affirming faith in mind, Sun San. He says, he quotes a sutra, the nature of reality is like an ocean. You should not say there is right or wrong. Well, here Muso is referring to a very lofty state of enlightenment. It's not that they're making judgments, but suppressing them. They do not see people in terms of self and other. This is the realm in which we can really uphold and embody the sixth and seventh precepts, not to speak of the faults of others, and not to praise oneself and disparage others, which I gather are the two most difficult precepts for most people to uphold. It helps if you don't see people in terms of self and other. That just pulls the root right out of such speaking of the faults of others and disparaging others. He continues, if people view the world in terms of distinctions between others and self, they will inevitably make judgments of right and wrong. If they entertain views of right and wrong, they are not true practitioners of the way, even if they refrain from expressing their views. These are high standards that he's offering up here. Rather than try to refrain from discussing judgments of others, therefore, practitioners of the Dharma should turn around and reflect, who is it that speaks of others' rights and wrongs? Or thinks? Who is it that thinks of others' rights and wrongs? It's a good way to apply the koan, who am I, or what am I, is when we catch ourselves having judgments of others, to ask, who is having these judgments? What is it that's judging? Sashin exposes this very ingrained habit of judging not only others, but oneself. It's one of the more painful things, especially for early sesshins, as I've heard and as I remember from those many years ago, of becoming aware of how reflexively, like a knee jerk, we impose judgments on other people in sesshin or outside sesshin. And ourselves. Pretty much always what we're doing with other people, we're doing with ourselves, and vice versa. It's because when the mind becomes quiet in sesshin, it exposes these habits. And of course, judgments is just one. It's a big one. It's a very common one. But we can't dodge these things, these internal judgments and other habits, mental habits. We can't deny them in the silence, in the stillness of sesshin. This is for many people. This is the most painful part of sesshin. It's not the pain in the knees or the hips or so forth. It's the pain of seeing how quick one is to judge oneself and others, and also how the mind has a mind of its own. It how little control we have over the mind, how it just rushes into these grooves that we've worn so deep for so many years, these tendencies, these propensities, as I was saying last night in the talk in the Zendo, these habit forces have such power over the mind. But as powerful as they are, they cannot prevail against the power of unrelentingly returning our attention to the practice we're working on. That's our trump card, to just use that practice, that diamond sword. It will enable us sooner or later to cut through these tendencies we have. It just takes so much practice. We've dug ourselves into such a deep hole through this habitual reactions, our mental reactions and our verbal reactions and our physical reactions. Our reactivity has gotten so much momentum behind it that it takes a lot of repetitive abstaining from these things when we catch ourselves, a lot of just withdrawing from these thoughts, these judgments, and returning the attention to this realm of no mind. Patience. But it would be a terrible mistake to think of, to be intimidated by the work before us, by this the labor of the task that we have to undergo to undo these things, these habit forces. Because what else are we going to do? Just live with them, continue to react in our lives out of these habit forces? That's not really an option. As slow as the progress may seem, it's what we have to do to live, to uphold our nature, and not just succumb to these forces. So we just accept it's a long job. He continues, he quotes a sutra that people take the physical constitution to be their own body and take the reflections of sense data to be their own mind. And then he comments, what this sutra is saying is that what ordinary people think to be their self is not the true self. And if you do not know what your true self is, you cannot see others as they really are either. So, just to go back to these habit forces, which, you know, a term for this in Asia is karma. It's our karma, our habit forces. What is the path of least resistance, because we've worn this path so thoroughly. To think that that is the true self is of course the big mistake. That is our karmic tendencies, but our true self is beyond those things. So many people in Sesshin, they keep when they see these forces, see our forces of greed and anger, irritability, the self-judgments, the judgments of others, they so easily imagine that that's the self. They see, oh, that's me. How awful. There I am. I keep doing this over and over again. How am I ever going to get past this? That's not who you are. That's not who we are. Those are just certain congealed energy patterns. They have no roots to them. There's no substance to them. They just have a certain habit energy. And what has developed, the habits that we have developed, this can, just as we've developed them, we can undo them. The worst thing to do when we continually in Sesshin see our unsavory tendencies, the worst thing is to then, well, judge ourselves, or to somehow disparage ourselves. That's what the mind wants. It'll do anything to get our attention off of the realm of no mind onto this habitual mind. So don't give it the satisfaction. Don't start beating up on yourself. That doesn't do a damn bit of good. Just when you notice these things, no matter if you've noticed them thousands of times, just redirect to the practice. Don't take the bait. He says, ordinarily, people who assume they are on the way, that is, practicing the Dharma, and do not talk about others right or wrong, still define good and bad in their minds and make distinctions of sharpness and dullness in people. Conceptualizing shallowness and depth of understanding, they contrast error and correctness of practice. Such people cannot proceed directly towards supreme enlightenment, so they are encouraged not to pay attention to judgments of right and wrong. Even those who have set aside all judgments of right and wrong and do not view people in terms of self and other cannot be said to be truly on the way as long as they have not seen the original state before personal history, or in terms of that koan, what is my true self before I was born, before my parents gave birth to me, before personal history. A way to see this original state is to turn the attention inward. What is it that distinguishes and defines self and others, body and mind? What is it that thinks of right and wrong and gain and loss? In ancient times, Nan Yue went to the sixth patriarch of Zen. Seeing him approach, the patriarch asked, "What is it that has come in this way?" Nan Yue was unable to answer, and he withdrew. And he spent 8 years doing Zazen and finally had a great realization. Returning to the patriarch, Nan Yue replied, "It would not be accurate to refer to it as something," which is a rather convoluted kind of response to our ears. This response did receive the approval of the master. We read these things in the something is lost in translation. To say it would not be accurate to refer to it as something. It sounds so conceptual or roundabout, but everything is always, everything depends on how it's said, the manner in which, the way he stood there, his bearing, his posture, the degree of centeredness, the sureness, the detachment, the clarity, the energy with which he said it. That's what would have mainly been the thing that prompted the master to approve his understanding. He continues, "It may seem that Nan Yue's inability to understand and answer immediately shows that he was dull. In actuality, however, the fact that he pursued the question, what is it that has come, to the very end, and ultimately came back with the answer, is evidence of his sharpness. Without this penetrating inquiry, you can never become enlightened. So yeah, Musso is making the point that, okay, he couldn't respond, and so he missed the boat, and he was kind of a loser. It's too easy to think of it in those terms, but look, you can't argue his success. All right, he spent 8 years. That was all time well spent. All those 8 years. He wasn't just wasting time. He was scouring the mind. He was probing. He was purifying the mind. He was sanding away these mental afflictions. And all of that work, all of those 8 years, went into that final awakening. So we must never think that being at a loss for a response, being stuck, is bad. It just has the potential of setting someone up to go deeper, to probe, and to really make a practice out of it. Surely no teacher would find fault with a student who is at a loss like that to respond. A teacher would see that student as, all right, now go to town with that. Got good grist for the mill there. You can use it. Here's another letter by Musso. There are people who say they believe in the Dharma or in Zen, who have practiced for years but without effect. The question is, what effects are they looking for? Some people want to be known or want to gain something for themselves. Some people pray to Buddhas and spirits to avert disaster and gain good fortune. This is a kind of a low level of what is sometimes called Buddhist practice, of praying for to get a car or a boyfriend or a house. Some people practice in hopes of gaining. No, some people study in hopes of gaining knowledge. Some people perform esoteric practices to get supernatural powers. Some people practice arts and skills to outdo others. Some people practice curing in an effort to heal sickness. In such affairs, one may talk about effects or their absence, but the message of Zen is not on this order. As far as the message of Zen is concerned, it has been said, this is inherent in everyone, complete in every individual, not less in ordinary people, not more in sages. These names, ordinary people and sages, is another way of saying the unenlightened and the enlightened. It's not less in the so-called unenlightened, nor more in the so-called enlightened. It is also said, it is complete, like cosmic space, without lack or excess. In our own chanting version of Affirming Faith and Mind, we made this, the way is perfect, like vast space, where there's no lack and no excess. Then Musso says, if you think you get some effect from practicing the Dharma, this is like seeing excess in cosmic space. If you think there is no effect, this is like seeing lack in cosmic space. In either case, you miss the point. Well, in either case, you're still caught in Tunis, to use another phrase from Affirming Faith in Mind, caught in causality. This and that, this leading to that. Yeah, that's valid enough on a certain level. Through long practice, serious practice, we become more aware, we become more calm and responsive to other people. But the real essence of this Dharma is not something in the realm of cause and effect, coming and going. It's not in the realm of attainment. It's just the way things are, the way we are. Like vast space where there's no lack and no excess. Among the most foolish of fools are people who worry that they will not get enlightened even if they practice the Dharma, and who thus give up the idea before they even try because they do not want to waste the time and effort. What in the world is a guaranteed success? Those who want to get paid before they do any work, so to speak, who demand assurance of success before they make any effort, will never get anywhere, either in the Dharma or in ordinary endeavors. Well, in this kind of rationalization, why do it when I don't know if it'll be worth all the time and effort? It's just oozing with I and me and my. Of course, you won't get anywhere with that kind of thinking. It's faith that's called for. Faith that in exerting oneself, one is in accord with one's nature. It is the way. Dogen, Zen Master Dogen said, exertion is not something that people of the world, worldly people, naturally love, but it is the last refuge of all. This exertion, the final refuge, it is our liberation. It is where we are most truly who we are, in our exertions. An ancient Zen master said that Zen meditation is of no benefit if the application of mind is unclear. This does not mean that it is useless for unlearned people to do Zen meditation. It is a warning to those who sit in an ignorant fog and call that Zen meditation. Yeah, it's a reminder that we have to find a way not to slip into drowsy states and just linger in this fog. Some people say that Zen meditation is not accessible to the unlearned, so they should recite sutras and incantations instead, because formal practices like recitations are easier and thus more conducive to realization. Sutras says, however, if the orientation of mind is not correct, all practices are in vain. All practices. So it's about the mind, our intention, our attitude that determines it. And we know that one doesn't doesn't have to be highly educated or even educated at all to come to awakening. In some ways, better off in terms of coming to awakening without all the learning that we've acquired that we have to find our way through or beyond. He then adds, this applies to Zen meditation as well as all formal practices. If the application of mind is correct, there will be no aberration in practices. Otherwise, all practices, whether formal or formless, concrete or abstract, are useless. Next one. Essential Zen meditation is not just a matter of controlling thoughts and keeping the body immobile, so we cannot say that it is important to sit facing a wall and stop thinking. Also, it is not a matter of contemplating doctrinal principles, so we cannot say it is important to learn doctrinal principles. This thing about cannot say it's important to sit facing a wall, well, it's not essential. The essence of Zen practice is not limited to any particular posture or facing any particular direction. But the point of sitting is it's exceedingly difficult to keep the mind free of thoughts in activity without sitting. Very difficult. People rationalize not sitting. I sometimes hear people say, well, I work at keeping my mind free of thoughts throughout the day when I'm working at home. And really? How is that working out for you? And it just the fact that that's enough for such people that they think that that's as good as sitting, that they don't really need the sitting because they're doing this other thing, it shows how much one can deceive oneself. They may honestly think that they're doing active Zen practice, and maybe in a kind of way they are, but what about the quality of it? What about the quality of it compared to how it would be if they were sitting for an hour or more or less a day? That's the thing. And then he continues, essential Zen meditation does not require wealth, of course, so we cannot say we are too poor to do it. It does not require physical strength, so we cannot say we are too weak to do it. It does not claim there is no Buddhism within worldly passions, so we cannot say that it is inaccessible to ordinary people. In other words, we can't tell ourselves that, okay, we still have these blind passions, so really we're not fit to be practicing the Dharma. No, that's not true at all. Who doesn't have these blind passions? Who doesn't have these afflictions? That's where we have to practice. That's it. We can't wait until we arrive at some would-be state of purity where we don't have emotional afflictions, reactive states, passions. We put down our sitting cushion where we are. Whatever our afflictions are, that's where the work starts. Here he compares the Zen school to other schools of of Buddhism. The various formal teachings and practices of Buddhism are designed as expedients to guide people according to their individual needs and potentials. They are formulated to lead people into the realm of enlightenment and are applied to the state where unenlightenment and enlightenment have already been distinguished. Zen, in contrast, aims for the fundamental state, which is prior to this distinction. Therefore, it does not admit of practices based on an existing dualism, but points directly to the primordial unity underlying fabricated dualities. As the third patriarch of Zen said, it is a mistake to apply the mind to the mind. All right, what's he saying here? I think he's talking again about various practices that we do in order to get this or that. Practices that have this different kinds of instrumental value. He's saying this is still in the realm of causality. Where, again, as he was just saying, in Zen we are going straight to this ground of mind. I've heard that in Tibetan Buddhism there is sometimes this criticism lobbed at Zen because we don't have more different kinds of practices. Practices of visualization, of prayer. There isn't more variety of practices in Zen, which is true. There isn't. And for those who want more variety, Zen may not be the thing. But what attracts, I think, those of us who stick with Zen is the simplicity of it. It's just to go to the root. I've probably told this story before, but I'll tell it once more. Where when I was just getting my practice off the ground and I was still living in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, there was Gary Snyder, who was one of the very earliest of Westerners to practice Zen in Japan. He had spent 8 years there in a Rinzai temple, and he had moved back to the States, and he came through Ann Arbor as a poet to speak at the invitation of, I don't know, the English department. And we got our little sitting group. Someone had the moxie to call up the host, where the guy whose house Gary Snyder was staying in that weekend, and asked if we might meet with him. And he graciously said, "Well, sure, come on over, and we'll have breakfast together." So there were, I don't know, five of us maybe who went over there, and I had some kind of a breakfast, cross-legged, in the living room of this English teacher, and then he took some questions from us, and one guy said, "What's the difference between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism?" And I still think back to that answer that Gary Snyder gave, because I think it's a very good one. He said, "Think of the mind as a great pond." In Tibetan Buddhism, you get in the water and you just make your way down, but slowly and thoroughly. You go around exploring all of the contours of that pond, the vegetation, the underwater vegetation, and you'd come to know the forms of marine life in there, the frogs and the fish and all. And it takes you quite a while to get to the bottom. By the time you get to the bottom, you have a very thorough understanding of that pond. And then he said, whereas in Zen, we just dive straight in and head for the bottom. And then, after hitting bottom, this would be like Kensho, after hitting bottom, then on the way up to explore the pond. So I think it's not a perfect analogy, because there's a lot of exploring that we do just with this very simple practice of the breath or the koan. A lot is revealed of the mind in doing that. That's the amazing paradoxical thing about Zen practice, is the more absorbed we become in just this one object of concentration, the breath or the koan, the more no-mindedly concentrated we are, the more of the mind, the phenomena of the mind, is revealed. The more the life of the pond is revealed. We're not consciously setting about with different forms of practice to look at this facet of the mind or that facet of the mind, this function of the mind or that function of the mind. It reveals itself. Those things reveal themselves just in this simple, single-minded practice of absorption. On what? On nothing. What is the breath? It's direct experience. It's just a process. It's just it's not a thing. It has no substance to it. And the koan, when we can get on a deeper level with it, we're seeing through the form of the koan, through the word mu, M-U, we're seeing through it into this realm of no-thingness. And in that process of focusing on it, then all these other things we see streaming past us are, again, our habit forces. We come to learn how we operate. We come to learn our reactive tendencies, our weaknesses that have no permanence to them. We come to learn firsthand through direct experience our conditioning, the things that have built up through our conditioning, through our socialization process, our how we were parented, how we were socialized in school, at home. We see these mental formations that have taken shape and have kind of acquired a life of their own. And that's all really valuable. But always in Zen, the real mission is to see through all forms. See through all these things. See the formlessness of form. The formlessness of all of these karmic tendencies. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.
Beings without number, I bow to the great endless blind patterns. I bow to the uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to
Benedict, the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind nations. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind nations. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.